once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
All right, now that we've got that out of the way...
We can go home.
Yeah, we're done now. We have said our names, and... Wait, nope, we have to disclose before we go home. First disclosure is that this program is called The Personal Wealth Coach.
Got it. Very okay, nice. I got that one down. I wrote that down.
Second one is that there are two bald men with beards having a conversation on the air. If that does not sit well with you, you may change the channel.
Channel?
Or, yeah. Yeah. Unless it's a podcast and then you have to just change the podcast.
Yes. Don't touch that dial.
Second thing, or third thing. After baldness and personal wealth coach, is that the personal wealth coach is not just the name of a podcast and a radio program. It is also the name of an SEC registered investment advisory firm. And that's not coincidental. The people that are talking to you are the principals at that firm. Just as a side note, just because the firm is registered with the SEC doesn't mean that the SEC has any kind of favorability, preference, or approval in any form, fashion, or inference in any particular way that the government approves of us. Period. Well, dot, 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 because we could continue that disclosure. The government's not good at approving of things. And we've got lots to say on that subject later. Okay. So, and also registered as an SEC investment advisor, that means gives fiduciary investment advice to people, which we can't do on the air because we don't know you all. And unless there's only one of you listening and we know you, in that case, I'm sorry, we didn't mean to tell you that we didn't know you.
But it would still violate privacy for us to give you that advice where everybody else could hear.
Because somebody else sneakily could turn on their radio right in the middle of the advice that we're broadcasting. So please consider what you're hearing today as educational material, kind of good information to let you know what's happening in the world and how to make decisions instead of what decision to make. There. I made that sufficiently non-legalese, I think, maybe.
I'll take your word for it.
Would you like to give a really legalese disclosure now?
The information we present on this educational radio and internet broadcast has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
And I deem that those warranties or guarantees that we don't give would be inaccurate if we had.
I don't know. You're getting too complex for me.
Yeah.
My brain on a Saturday morning can't handle that.
Right. Okay. And the last, but not least, is that this is not a paid commercial program. We don't pay for this program, and they don't pay us to do it. So it's some kind of a weird volunteer thing that we've been doing for 25 years now on the air. So it's not paid commercial program. However, we do advertise on the station there. We actually get a discount on our advertising.
We do?
Yeah. Our prices have not changed on what we pay for advertising per minute in like 10 years.
Don't tell them that.
Right. So they actually are giving us that could amount to being paid if you think about it from that perspective.
No, I think it's the laws of supply and demand. I think advertising in general has declined in AM radio.
During that same 10-year period.
And so they're really happy to still have us.
Oh, that could be. We are regular as clockwork. The thing that we advertise for on the station, by the way, isn't us. It's for the radio program. So they may give us a discount on that as well.
We do use the name of our firm, which happens to be the name of the radio program. So there's significant advantages.
Senator, there is a quid pro quo. I mean, people hear us, and if they don't immediately change the channel based on our humor and baldness, people that tend to listen to us for a while might decide to use our services to give them advice on how to invest stuff if they've got high net worth. So it's not like we don't get anything for talking about this stuff, but it's not our major motivation. We are semi-motivated by that. I mean, it's nice to get new clients, but it's not something that we're actively looking for right now.
Probably getting a little overkill on the disclosures.
Well, I mean, what we should just spend the whole hour on disclosures and see if we really have enough people that care about who we are as people to not change the channel.
Channel?
No, no, no. Or podcast. Could be.
Oh, don't touch that dial.
Yeah. Where there's a radio channel, it has to be dredged every once in a while to make sure that it's deep enough. All right. So what happened in the market this week?
The market behaved oddly this week. The S&P 500 stock index, the one we generally report on, because while it's an imperfect index and an imperfect indicator of the market, it's the one that's reasonably, the most accurate, reasonably popular one. The Dow Jones 30 Industrials, which is even more popular, is only 30 stocks and sometimes not a particularly good indication of what's going on in the market. The S&P 500 into the week at 3911.74, for those of you who follow such things, that's up 6.45% for the week. Now,
that's the weird thing about it. Did anybody tell the market that this is 2022? That's weird. We have an up in the market in 2022. I think there must have been a memo that went to the wrong place. Maybe the mail took a long time to arrive and it had a 2021 date on it. And so the market said, all right, this week we're up.
There's obviously a problem. Last week we had a big dip in the market because of the Federal Reserve saying, hey, we're going to raise interest rates 0.75%. But it didn't occur on the day they said it.
No.
It occurred the next day,
right?
Which means there is a lag there somewhere.
Maybe
the lag is not in Asia because it was already tomorrow in Asia.
Was it going out by mail?
I don't know. Something happened.
I know that the just-in-time delivery method is broken right now, but you would think that the news from the Federal Reserve would happen to the market on the same day. It doesn't.
If it went out by the United States Postal Service, it would have never happened.
Yeah, never would have arrived. That's what you're saying.
Or would have arrived in the wrong place or several days late or something
like that. Right, right.
So that is a peculiarity. I do think a lot of the investment decisions are made after the market closes. So people were mulling it around all night in the wherever people mull around such things.
You're applying logic to this. It's just much better if we act like we don't understand what's going on.
Anyway. So, but for the week, it was up 6.45%. Now that's kind of significant. Why is that significant? Because for instance, the three-year average return, total return, or three-year average appreciation, let's put it like this, of the S&P 500 stock index is 10.32% a year. That's the average. It was up 6.45% in a single day. That is unusually volatile, and we have high variance or high volatility. It's down 17.93% this year, which, by the way, does not mark the end of the bear market. The collective wisdom of the pundits on Wall Street is that when the market rises 20% from its bottom, wherever that bottom is, in other words, when the market has a collective 20% rise from a recent bottom, that's the end of the bear market. Why that particular definition, I don't know, but it's the one that's reported routinely in the Wall Street Journal. So, but it hasn't done that. It's only up. The lowest point it hit was actually day before yesterday.
Do you know what the dictionary says? What? A market in which share prices are rising, encouraging buying.
The end of the bear market?
No. A bull market is a market in which share prices are rising, encouraging buying. That's the whole definition. Yep. So we could say we're in a bull market now. Investopedia says a commonly accepted definition of a bear market is when stock prices rise by 20% after two declines of 20% each.
Wait a minute. A commonly, read that again. You said definition of a bear market is when prices rise 20%.
No, a definition of a bull market.
Oh, you said bear market the first time.
The bull market, a commonly accepted definition of a bull market is when stock prices rise by 20% after two declines of 20% each. I've never heard that one. That's what they say on Investopedia. So what we consider the common definition of a bull market is a rise of 20% from the lowest that the market was in the bear market that preceded it. So
yeah, that makes sense.
So what else happened in the market? We're still in a bear market. We're not.
Well, as I said, the market is still down 17.93% from the beginning of the year. It's still down 8.62% from this time last year. So we're still in a bear market. Most of the commentators who have been reasonably accurate in the past, in my experience, have suggested this is what's called a bear market rally. They happen. They definitely happen during a bear market. And why? Well, historically, almost without exception, and I looked for an exception and couldn't find one, but I've read that there are exceptions. A bear market ends with something called capitulation.
Right.
And a capitulation is really easy to see. The last sellers sell, and the market suddenly plunges, and there is a collective wisdom that emerges in the media that the life as we know it is coming to an end, and the market will probably go to zero. I used to have, when I was a broker, when I was a stockbroker, I used to have a brokerage customer who lived in Houston who literally was a little old lady who wore tennis shoes. And she would always mark the bottom of corrections in bear markets. Yeah. She was extremely reliable because she would always call and want to sell everything. And when the day she called and wanted to sell everything was always the absolute bottom in the market. I miss her tremendously. She's no longer with us, but I miss her tremendously.
We had a name for that, by the way. It was the old lady in tennis shoes indicator. And when
little
she called up,
yeah, little,
when she called up and she said, I need to buy with every available dollar that you have in the account, we would go, uh-oh, that's the end of the bull.
End of the bull market. Yeah.
We're about to have a dip. And then when she called up and said, sell everything I have immediately, we would say, all right, well, we're about to begin the upward rise. And it was so accurate.
Actually, there was another lady who was a very consistent indicator of the top of bull market who's also no longer with us, an elder lady. She was in her 80s at the time. She would call and want to buy some exotic stock, often a foreign stock, that she had heard about in her quilting guild. And when the ladies in the quilting guild start talking about buying stocks, the last buyers in a bull market either have just bought or are about to buy, and that's the end of the bull market. By the way, that's how when bear markets and bull markets end. When the last people who are going to sell, sell, that's the end of the bear market. When the last people who are going to buy, buy, that's the end of the bull market. Why? Well, if everybody who's going to buy has already bought, there's nobody left to buy, and there's probably somebody who's willing to sell.
Right.
And since all the buyers have already bought, there's nobody to catch the price when it starts down. The other side of it is, when the last people who want to sell, sell, that's it. From there on, there's only buyers and the market goes up. And right. There is such a thing as momentum. It's psychological momentum where people make up their mind. Now, does that mean that this is definitely not the end of the bear market? No. One of the most fascinating things, if you want to study bear markets, and I have, is they're all different. They have many of the major bear markets have certain similarities. But if you look at them carefully and you analyze the news media reports that were going on during the time and what people were writing that they were saying at that time, they're all different. So we don't know. And that's the point. That's why market timing, by the way, doesn't work. If there was a surefire way of spotting the bottom on a bear market, then market timing would work perfectly. However, study after study has shown that if sets of investor behaviors, market timers consistently have the worst long-term return, the very worst long-term return. And people who buy and hold generally have the best long-term return. And that's reality. It doesn't seem intuitive, which is probably why it works. Anyway, that was the S&P 500. The CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, which we also follow, was up 4.87% for the week to 2279.04. It's down 12.25% this year, down about 7% from this time last year. Well, that's it. The yield on the U.S. 10-year Treasury also did something, and it's worth talking about. The Treasury note yield, which is an indication of what the Treasury, the bond market collectively, the people who trade in the bond market, think interest rates are going to be doing in the future, rose to about 3.3% midweek. Now, let me put that in context. 18 months ago, it was less than 1%. It's now 3.3%. That's a huge rise. But then in the rest of the week, it slid downward and closed the week at 3.135%. The interest rates in the latter half of the week, as the market was going up, interest rates came down. And there's really very good reasons for that. We can talk about that at some length. The Treasury curve is still positive. For those who don't know what the Treasury curve is or what it means, the Treasury curve is we look at the interest yield on Treasury securities, and in a normal positive curve, shorter maturing Treasury securities have lower yields, and longer maturing Treasury securities have higher yields, because if you're going to loan money to somebody for a longer period of time, you expect to get a higher interest rate. The risk goes up that something will happen.
A quick parallel that a lot of people experience in their lives is when they're buying a house or refinancing their house, and they see that the interest rate on a 15-year note on your house is lower than on a 30-year. Same true when you're buying a car. You tend to have higher interest rates for a 7-year period than for a 3-year mm-hmm. period. So that's healthy. Now, that's a good thing, because they're putting their money at risk for 7 years instead of 3 years. They want something paid back for it.
When that reverses, so that short-term interest rates are higher than long-term interest rates, it is a strong, strong, strong indicator we're about to have a recession.
We're not experiencing that right now. We have a positive yield curve. That's a very positive sign for the economy.
Okay. Yes. The price of, so that's the 30-year bonds out there at 3.265%, and the 2-year note is at 3.063. Doesn't sound like there's a huge difference between them, but that's really a pretty normal spread. Now, West Texas Intermediate crude oil also did something pleasant. It moved from it dropped $13 over the last 2 weeks, and it's now at 107.53.
Where did it drop that money? Because I can pick it up if it doesn't need it anymore.
In futures contracts.
Ah, okay. I found it. I thought you was on the floor somewhere. Just dropping.
So
money.
if you shorted the futures contracts from 2 weeks ago and cashed in today, you could pick up $13 a barrel. That's right.
Nice.
And that's really nice. Anyway, 107.53. Now, let's put that in context. Without the Russian invasion of Ukraine, West Texas Intermediate crude was forecast to get to around $100 a barrel this summer. It is around $100 a barrel, but
107.
Those 107, admittedly, but they certainly didn't forecast upper fours. Well, the average cost of a gallon of regular gasoline across the United States right now is over $5. They didn't forecast that. Why is the price of gasoline so high and the price of diesel so high? Simply, Russia invaded Ukraine. Europe and the United States have basically embargoed Russian oil, which puts a significant shortage of oil in the world markets. This is part of it. This isn't all of it. So we've pulled a lot of oil out of the markets. When there's a shortage of a commodity and there's an increase in demand for that commodity, the price goes up, and that's why the price of gasoline and diesel is up. Now, there's a second cause of the shortage, which you may elaborate on at great length. During the pandemic, the price of oil and the price of gasoline got so low, the price of petroleum in general got so low, that investors were losing a lot of money, particularly in refineries. And so people stopped investing, and corporations stopped investing in refineries. They started shutting down refineries because it just wasn't profitable to keep them open. And this is a free enterprise society, so we certainly allow that. But the government doesn't say you can't close that refinery. Several refineries were literally converted to biofuels that were previously producing petroleum-based fuels. So now there is a shortage of refinery capacity as well as a shortage of gasoline in Europe. Because there's such a shortage of gasoline in Europe and some other places too, they are willing to pay a lot for gasoline. So gasoline that's made in the United States is not only staying in the United States, it's also being shipped around the world because of, again, the shortage of Russian petroleum. And Russia has a lot of refineries, and they produced a lot of gasoline for Europe, and Europe's not buying their gasoline anymore, so the price of gasoline goes up. That's a real quick and dirty picture of that.
And we'll have more on that subject in just a minute. What did you have for the rest of the market?
That's all the market I was going to talk about today.
Well, then it's less than a minute. It's now. The present is here. Wait a minute. It was here back before that too. But anyway, all right. I have a whole bunch to talk about on that subject. And people that have listened to the radio program for a while know I follow the oil industry very closely. I look at number of rigs out there. I look at fracking. I understand how oil production works. I give advice on depletion calculations on individual oil wells, things like that. I'm not a geologist, but I am an economist. So I talk to geologists about this, though, because in order to make any kind of a profitability forecast or even just production forecast, you have to understand how this stuff works. So that's a bit of my background. I am absolutely not against the oil industry. I think that's kind of silly to say you're against any industry. It's an industry that we need right now. Even the president is saying to the refineries, please increase your capacity. So you mentioned this. During the pandemic, our demand for oil and gas dropped. CNBC interviewed ExxonMobil's CEO this week, Darren Woods, and he said something that was fascinating. They're predicting that by the year 2040, that's 18 years from today, actually 17 and a half years, every new passenger car sold in the world will be electric. This is Exxon making that prediction. Are they likely, knowing those numbers, going to increase their capacity to refine gas, spend more money on that? Probably not. So that's one piece. In 2021, this is the numbers that we now have, 9% of all passenger car sales were electric vehicles. That's globally. Only about 5% in the United States. The majority of that stuff was taking place in China. But 9% of all new car sales in 2021 were electric. Now, having said all that, the president's asking the refineries to increase capacity. Are we using more gas today than we were a year ago? Are we driving more? No.
Really?
We're driving more, but our use of gasoline products is down about 8% year over year. We're using less gasoline today than we were a year ago. And a year ago, we were using less gasoline than 2 years before that. And in 2020, we used a whole bunch less. So if you look back through what we have is our use of gasoline is well below the average from 2017 to 2019. Well, why? Well, because 9% of all new cars were electric. How far below the demand are we today from what we were during the average of 2017 to 2019? We're about 8% less gas used. So those numbers kind of line up. We're selling more electric vehicles. We also lowered the capacity at the refineries by 800,000 barrels a day during the pandemic. And we haven't brought that back online, and it's unlikely that we will, because the predictions for 2022 and the actual sales for 2022 are putting the United States purchases of electric vehicles at much higher than 5%, like it was last year. It's catching up to what is going on elsewhere in the world. New cars, people look at the price. If you're going to pay $5 a gallon at the pump, people are looking at the prices on electric vehicles, which are rising, but not as fast as other vehicles are rising in price, which is weird. So when you tie this all together and you add the fact that ethanol prices are way up, the reality is that our demand for gas is down. Our capacity and our production of gas is down. So there's less of it out there. And then Russia hit Ukraine. And I'm going to say something bad about Biden, and then I'm going to say something bad about Trump. How's that? Soon as Biden was elected, first month in office, one of the first things he did is suspend the leasing of federal land for oil and gas. Said, hey, not till we get a report on the long-term environmental impact of these things. So that sounds really bad, but then 3 months later, less than 3 months later, 2.5 months later, they got the report and leasing began again. Okay, so he suspended leasing. That's not positive for oil and gas. Now I'm going to say the bad thing about Trump, which really isn't a bad thing about Trump. And that is that the last 4 years of the Obama administration had more oil and gas leases than the full 4 years of the Trump administration. Oil and gas production is not as high as it was, period. And it's ramping down, not up. Now, we're surging upward right now because prices are up. But if I were to give advice to a company that is producing oil and gas and they're about to buy equipment that they'll pay for over the next 30 years, well, the CEO of ExxonMobil said 100% of passenger cars in the world in 18 years are going to be electric. Are you planning on getting into a 30-year loan to increase your refinery capacity right now? Would you do that? I would not. That's the issue right now, is that technology isn't all there yet. This is like pre-supply chain fuddling, because electric cars are not being produced at the efficiency they need to be, and there are not enough of them yet. But the writing is on the wall. They're already, even at the lackluster performance of an electric car today, it's already more cost-effective if you're driving inside a city to have an electric vehicle than to have a gas vehicle in the same class. So that's the writing on the wall. It doesn't say oil and gas is bad or this is all happening because of ecological reasons or any of that. Because the reality is it's happening for financial reasons. If it's less expensive to drive a car for the length of its car and it's better as far as quality, and that's the other part that comes out, is that people are more proud of their vehicle 6 months later, by far, in all the surveys, when their vehicle's an electric versus any other model. And that includes all the luxury models. So if you're more satisfied with your car, you like it more, you have less maintenance issues, and it long-term costs less to own it, that's when people start doing it. And it's really nice to be able to congratulate themselves later and say, yes, I'm contributing to global green energy, blah, blah, blah. That's not what it's about. It's about it's cheaper. And that is when we're experiencing a pinch like this, where we're looking around and saying, Russia's not able to sell its gasoline to the market the same way it used to, either because people have decided not to buy it or because government sanctions have said don't buy it. By the way, that's not the case in oil and gas. Oil and gas is pretty well immune to that, except for insurance, federally subsidized insurance on oil tankers. That's the only part of sanctions that hits oil and gas. The banking of oil and gas is not sanctioned. It's all free market still. And yet people are buying less of it from Russia because they don't think it's a good idea to invade their neighbors. So those prices are coming to the pump. We're increasing our production. And we haven't hit the full capacity at the refineries yet. We're predicting it to be hit sometime in October. At which point we won't have the ability to produce more gasoline than we're producing right now. And that will be the maximum. But if we're already using less gas, and there's some great surveys out on that right now, people are driving less now than they were a month ago. They're carpooling more. If they're going on vacation, they're taking one car instead of two or three. And that's cool. A year ago at this point, oil and gas was right around per barrel. Oil was in the mid 60s, and it's 107 now. Well, that will cause you to drive less. So that's what's going on out there. Yeah, there's stuff politically that causes oil to be more expensive. But Trump didn't go out and say, I want to lease less land than Obama did. In fact, he was encouraging it. But the money's just not there. In fact, that one of those years was right in the middle of the pandemic when things got crushed. It isn't Trump's fault that oil and gas got crushed in the pandemic. But when they look at having to spend many billions of dollars financed over decades to pay for increased capacity, when they look decades ahead and say that's going to be way too much capacity in decades, we're going to have to figure out how to pay for this later. And a lot of these publicly traded companies they've gotten to be pretty smart on how to stay profitable in bad times. So they're not going to spend a whole bunch of money right now. They're making the money that they need to make to tide them over when we stop buying their stuff. And there, I've wrapped it up. There you go.
Well, we got two questions from John, and I want to decompose consumer price inflation. So what should we
wait? Decompose is like rot. You're going to rot the consumer price index?
I'm actually going to reduce it to its basic elements.
Ooh, you lovely. Let's talk about organic stuff here.
Okay.
Yeah, we got two good questions from Inquisitor John. Thank you, John. We appreciate your questions. Do you want to take one of them?
And it circled something in the Wall Street Journal, sent us a picture, which he normally does. And it says the U.S. already descending into recession, economists. First off, somebody that says economist says, rather than saying that a name, I don't pay a lot of attention to it at that point. The U.S. is not descending into a recession. I don't care what economist says it is. We have some very clear indications that occur when we begin descending into a recession. Now, those indications sometimes are there when we don't have a recession, but we don't have recessions without those indications. For example, let me give you a parallel here that I think you'll understand. If you have a fever, you may or may not have COVID. But if you have a significant COVID infection, you're ill. I don't just mean you have the virus in you. You are ill from COVID, you will have a fever. So you can't mix those
like
two
Wait a minute. This is like an SAT question.
Yeah, it is.
All human men are human, but not all humans are men.
That's certainly true.
Okay.
All men are humans, but not all humans are men. Think what you're trying to say.
Yes, but I added extra words to make it more obvious. Yeah.
Right.
Or is it obviouser?
We're not. It can be. Recessions can be generated. It can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. What happens is people think, they read and they hear we're going into a recession and they say, I better save my money. By the way, that's how we get recessions. I better save my money and stop spending. I better stop buying things. I better stop charging things on my credit card because we got a recession coming. That will create a recession.
However, more specifically, zooming in, small business owners and businesses saying, I'm laying people off because we're going into a recession. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Our profits are up, but we're going to lay people off because it looks like a recession. That's self-fulfilling. Go ahead.
But we're not seeing that. As a matter of fact, what we're seeing is the surveys, the small business surveys that we see from the Association of Small Businesses. Are saying, oh no, we're having a recession, things are bad, they're going to get worse. By the way, they virtually always say that when a Democrat is in the White House, because most small business owners are Republicans. And so they are in the gloom and doom mode. And they will also be unreasonably optimistic when a Republican is in the White House. But what you watch is what they're doing, not what they're saying. And we watch small business hiring, and the complaint that the surveys are getting from small business owners is they can't find enough people to hire. If they thought we were going into a recession and they were pulling back at this point, the first thing they would do is stop hiring people.
Right.
Large businesses, in some cases like Tesla, have a hiring freeze on.
And
they say we're going to lay off some people.
Correct.
But they haven't done it yet. But by the way, if you check with the Tesla details on why Elon Musk says that he's going to lay off 10% of his workforce, first off, it's not 10% of his workforce, it's 10% of the executives. He feels like he's got too many executives, too many white-collar executives. The second reason is he said he can't get the parts that he needs to make his vehicles, even though demand is still way up there. That is not a trigger for that. That's why he may need to lay some people off, because he can't get parts to make his vehicles. That's not recession generating typically. So what we see is that businesses and consumer sentiment indices are notoriously non-predictive. Business opinions about the future of the economy small business at least, are notoriously non-predictive. Large businesses, publicly traded corporations, have a much better handle on whether we're going to have a recession or not, because they generally go off of data rather than off gut feeling. So we're not in the position yet. We could get there, but we're not in the position yet where small businesses, our businesses in general, are creating a self-fulfilling prophecy of creating a recession.
I have a fantastic book by Roger Farmer, called The Macroeconomics of Self-Fulfilling Prophecies. It's a thing, and you can read about it and understand which parts of self-fulfilling prophecies cause them to occur and which parts don't. So when there's a sentiment, like consumer sentiment right now is really low, well, that's not a predictor of anything if they're still spending. A real predictor is how consumer spending is doing. So consumer sentiment lines up with consumer spending. If they're both going down, that's an indicator. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But if spending's going up, right, as everybody's saying, this is horrible, it means that they think somebody else might lose their job, but they think their job is fine. My job is fine. I think somebody else might lose theirs. I'm going to keep spending. That's good for the economy.
The surveys are consistently at extreme low points, as low as they were in 2020 about the future of the economy.
Right. And they really haven't ever recovered from the pandemic. The sentiment on the future of the economy never got up again to where it was in 2019.
However, the credit card companies are saying consumers are increasing their use of credit cards and their accumulation of credit card debt. So those two are completely reversed from each other. It's the old story, watch what they do, not what they say.
Yeah.
And I think that's completely true.
If you would like to join the conversation, we're taking questions by email, jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa, Whiskey Charlie, or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. All right. And we'll play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We have another question from Inquisitor John, our most faithful questioner. The subject is crypto recommended for the efficient frontier. His question is, what are uncorrelated assets and how do they impact the efficient frontier? And there's a picture of the Wall Street Journal, and on it, it says, one of the core investing concepts of moving out on the efficient frontier, making a portfolio less volatile for the same amount of return by adding uncorrelated assets. Oh, my goodness. That's a lot to take in. We deal with this stuff every day, but if I just started a conversation with somebody with that mouthful of jargon, the eye glaze starts, and if I'm at a mixer with a bunch of adults, if I started a conversation like that, I would watch the whole group kind of look around for somebody else to talk to. But I think everybody that's listening to this know what they got into. What is the efficient frontier? What is an uncorrelated asset class? Oh my goodness. An asset class has a kind of a definition, and we always talk about this. Who sets the definitions in finance? Well, kind of sort of consensus. You can go to three different finance dictionaries and get three completely different definitions for a bull market. And that's one we would think everybody would have a common understanding of. Three different definitions for a bull market, for real? So what is the efficient frontier? This is based in the concept that we now call modern portfolio theory, if people have talked about that, or asset allocating, asset allocation in your portfolio. It comes from a paper that was written in 1952 called Portfolio Selection. It had some other stuff. Dr. Sharp and Dr. Markowitz contributed a bunch of stuff on the metrics on how to measure risk versus return. And if you mix a bunch of assets together, they can sort of act as like shock absorbers against each other if they don't all go up at the same time and all go down at the same time. Really, really simple and maybe oversimplified concept is, say you have some stocks and some bonds, and interest rates go up, but at the same time, profitability goes up for the companies. You might see the stocks go up and the bonds go down, and vice versa. Interest rates dropping, but the corporation's profits are just barely petering out, or they're flat from last year. You might see the stock market go down and the bond market go up. Now, assuming that the company stays around for the next 20 years and they pay their debts on time, the reality is that both of those investments from the beginning made a profit, the stock and the bond. The bond is a loan to the company and the stock is an owning of the company. So those are not totally correlated asset classes. They go up sort of sometimes at different times, but they're what we call highly correlated. They're the same company. So if that company says we're going to go bankrupt, the bond's going to go down and the stock's going to go down. So if you want to have to measure this stuff, you have to get what's called diversified. You have to group all these big companies that are sort of the same together, and that's called an asset class. Now, what's an asset class? And this is, again, definitions are different, but it comes from a paper written in 1952 by Markowitz. And Markowitz has a definition for asset classes. So I think that's a pretty good reference point. His definition is a group of value-generating entities that have an objective way of determining their value or what they are. So if a company has, if you think of a book value is just like the net worth. If you take all your debts and subtract them from all your assets, that's your net worth. And for a company, that would be a book value. The book value is a net worth. Okay. If a company is valued by the market, the auction market, the stock market, has it valued below its book value, that's called a value company. Because its assets are worth more than the market's giving. If the market's valuing it right at its book value, that's still called a value company because it's being valued on what it owns. A growth company could be valued way above its net worth because we think it's going to have really good profitability and growth in that profitability into the future. Hey, look at all the money they're making. Yeah, it's a lemonade stand, and if they went bankrupt and had to sell the table and the cups, they're not going to get very much money left. Their net worth isn't that great, but they're making $800 a day. So they're valued on their earnings. That's a growth company. So these two don't act the same way. General Mills, a Cheerios company, does not act the same way that Tesla does. Tesla's being valued on its what people think it's going to earn into the future. And General Mills is, yeah, it's profitable, but it's being valued based on what its net worth is and what its profitability is at a very low level. People don't think that they're going to eat 8 boxes of Cheerios a day into the future. It's probably going to eat your one bowl and that's it. It's not a growth company. It's a value company. They're not correlated. All right. Since my career and way, way back before my career part started, people have been saying, hey, you need to get this other asset class in your portfolio. It's totally not correlated. So that should lower your risk. If you have stocks and bonds and they're going up long term, but they go up and down at different times from each other, your average is less bumpy because they're shock absorbing. Well, the endowment manager at Yale University during the Great Recession was this guy who said, hey, I've got an alt asset class, and you'll hear that term a lot. And I'm going to put it in the portfolio because it doesn't go up when the market does. It doesn't go down when the market does. But long term, it's way up. And his alternate asset class was a bunch of lumberland, millions upon millions of acres of lumberland, but it wasn't being harvested annually, monthly, quarterly. It was set to be harvested in 40 years. That doesn't meet the definition, according to Markowitz, of an asset class. It's not creating a value right now. It may create a value in 40 years, but it's not producing value today. So we would call that an unproductive land. It's like a collectible. What does gold do? That's not an asset class, but companies that mine gold, that are trying to be profitable even when gold prices are down, we would group those companies together as an asset class. when people say we want to use cryptocurrency as an alternate asset class to lower the risk in your portfolio, they don't know what an asset class is. Bitcoin's crypto, that's a collectible. What does Bitcoin create? It's like a gold coin. It doesn't mean you can't make a profit in it, but it's not creating a value of its own. It's not like a company, it's not like the lemonade stand where they're making lemonade, turning lemons, which aren't that expensive, and water that's not that expensive, and sugar that's not that expensive, and little kid smiles, which aren't that expensive, into great profits. That's value creation. That can be quantified and say this group is doing something that's trying to be profitable even in downtimes. So when people say we should throw in cryptocurrency as an alternate asset class to bring you up to the efficient frontier to lower your risk, it's just that's like, wrong. It's wrong. It's just like raw land in there, or gold, or a cow that you don't intend to sell. Go ahead.
It's important to recognize something too. In order for an asset class to lower risk, it has to be non-correlative. Well, guess what? If you look at high-tech speculative stocks and you look at the price of Bitcoin,
they're very correlated. They go up at the same time. They go down at the same time.
They go up and down precisely the same way, just Bitcoin goes up and down more. Actually, Bitcoin increases the volatility, variance, and market risk of the typical portfolio. The only people who say they would love you to get Bitcoin in your portfolio
are people that are selling Bitcoin.
Basically somebody who wants to sell Bitcoin. That's it in a nutshell. Or true believers.
Right.
Who believe that, who irrationally believe that Bitcoin is valuable, which it isn't.
Right. I mean, and it is valuable. I'm going to contest that. It's valuable as long as people are willing to pay for it. It's like a trading card or a gold coin. If there's a market out there for it and people, the true believers, want to keep buying it, there will always be a value there if there's people still willing to buy it. But in a collectible way.
Well, let me say why I don't think it's valuable. If we take a given Bitcoin, and there have been quite not Bitcoin, but a given cryptocurrency, and there have been probably about 20 that I know of now, about half of those have declined to zero and disappeared.
Wait, are you saying you only know of 20 cryptocurrencies?
That I know of off the top of my head. Probably more.
There are thousands.
Well, then...
It makes your point more clearly to know that there are thousands of them.
Something that is out there that has no value is not valuable. And crypto, my definition of value, at least, in order to, we're out of time.
Yeah, we got it.
This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back next hour with more.
Thank you very much for listening, and we'll have more to talk about.